Hi, I'm Rowan Molyneux, and you're listening to Oddity, the podcast about all things strange and unexplained. In this episode, we'll be discussing a case which lasted for over 14 months, turning the lives of one ordinary family upside down, and leaving an impact which can still be felt four decades later. In late August of 1977, in a council house in the North London borough of Enfield, Janet Hodgson was upstairs in her bedroom. She lived at 284 Green Street with her mum Peggy, her older sister Margaret, and her younger brothers Johnny and Billy. Her mum and dad were recently divorced, and her dad had moved out, but they had a good support system, with friendly neighbours and family living close by. On that particular night, just 1 week before Janet was due to start secondary school, strange things started to happen. Janet and Margaret heard an unusual shuffling noise in the room and, confused and a little bit afraid, called downstairs for their mum. Peggy, a straightforward woman who took no nonsense from her four kids, came up and told them to go to bed. They calmed down and she went back downstairs, leaving Janet and Margaret in the room. But things were about to get a whole lot worse. For a little while, everything was peaceful. No more mysterious shuffling noises. Then suddenly, a heavy chest of drawers slid across the room, as if moved by invisible hands. The children were terrified and once again yelled for their mum. Peggy pushed the chest back into place, then watched in horror as it slid out again. This time when she tried to shove it back against the wall, it wouldn't move. Unnerved, she took the kids downstairs into the living room. By now, banging noises were heard coming from the walls, and voices seemed to come from other rooms. Peggy ran next door to beg the neighbours to come over and check the house for intruders. Nobody was found, but the banging continued, moving around the walls and at one point seeming to come from under the floor. In an attempt to find the source of the noise, one of the neighbours, a builder called Vic, even checked the pipes for problems. Finally, at her wit's end, Peggy called the police. They too searched the house thoroughly, but found nothing untoward. While they were there, however, a police officer saw a chair slide across the floor, right in front of her eyes. Astounded, she checked for wires or any evidence of trickery, but signed a statement to say that she was convinced that nobody there had touched it. The strange activity continued unabated over the next few days, terrifying and exhausting the Hodgson family, and eventually the newspapers were called. When the Daily Mirror visited, a Lego brick flew across the room and hit one of their photographers right in the head. After this, somebody at the Daily Mirror made the decision to get in touch with their contact at the Society for Psychical Research. The Society for Psychical Research was founded in 1882. Among its alumni are names such as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Freud, Jung, and two British prime ministers. Its purpose is to conduct scholarly research into events and abilities described as psychic or paranormal. A number of SPR members visited Enfield over the next 14 months, but two in particular became deeply involved in the case. Their names were Morris Gross and Guy Lyon Playfair, and they were regular visitors to the Hodgson household. The strange phenomena they witnessed were at first in line with typical cases involving poltergeists. Doors opened on their own, coins and stones dropped onto the floor out of thin air, and Lego bricks and marbles were hurled across the room by an invisible force. The marbles, when picked up, were hot to the touch, a classic element of poltergeist activity. Puddles also appeared from nowhere, inexplicably disappearing and reappearing. And of course, the knocking continued. Unsurprising, as the word poltergeist comes from the words poltern, to make noise, and geist, spirit. A noisy ghost. Then things started to escalate. A heavy sofa turned itself over in a room full of people. An armchair slid across the floor. An iron fireplace casing was yanked out of a wall. And a mirror even caught fire. As often happens in these situations, Janet became the centre of the events. This is normal, insofar as the word normal can be applied to this sort of thing, as poltergeist activity is often focused on teenage girls. Janet's experience may not have been quite as violent as some others which have been reported, but the prolonged nature of the activity undoubtedly took a heavy toll. Once, the curtain was seen to twist itself strangely around her neck as she lay in bed, even though the windows were closed and nobody's hands were anywhere near the fabric. She was frequently seen to levitate, as supposedly caught on camera in the now famous photograph. People outside the house also witnessed her levitating. A lollipop lady standing at the crossing spotted her through a window, apparently floating up and down in a horizontal position, limbs flailing. A bakery worker walking down the street also saw her flying around the room and reported that the curtains seemed to be blowing in a strong breeze, although once again, the windows were shut. Janet also began to go into violent trances, shaking and thrashing around as if she were having a fit. They feared that she would end up hurting herself in one of these fits, and sometimes it took a number of fully grown men to restrain her. At one point, she ran across the room and hit her head against the wall. Another night, she was put to bed fast asleep after being heavily sedated by a doctor. The adults downstairs heard a huge crash and, running upstairs, they found Janet was curled up on top of a tall chest of drawers, still out cold. Despite this worrying turn of events, she was found to be physically and mentally healthy. And then they made contact with something. Initially, Morris Gross had questioned the spirit using a traditional method. Knock once for no, twice for yes. "Do you enjoy scaring these people?" he asked. Two knocks. Yes. "You should go, you've scared them for long enough," he told the presence. "Are you going to go away?" One knock. No. "Did you die in this house?" Two knocks. Yes. "Are you unhappy?" One knock. No. But that was just the start. Noises were heard to come from Janet's direction, often seeming to emanate from a spot just behind her. First whistling, then barking sounds. Guyly and Playfair consulted a colleague who suggested that if it could whistle and bark, then it could talk. Next time the noises started, Morris Gross challenged the entity to speak. And it did. The voice that came out of Janet's mouth didn't sound like that of an 11-year-old girl. Instead, the voice that emanated from the child was deep and gravelly, the croaking tones of an old man. That's how the family came to learn the name of the presence. It said its name was Bill Wilkins. Speech therapists determined that Janet was able to make these sounds by using her false vocal cords at the back of her neck. It's not unusual for people to use these cords when they want to put on a low, rasping voice. But what the speech therapists couldn't explain is how Janet could keep the voice up for so long. This sort of thing is quite a strain, and prolonged use of the false vocal cords will usually give you a sore throat in just a few minutes. Janet, or Bill, could have conversations that lasted hours. Morris Gross believed that something really was speaking through Janet. He even offered £1,000 to anybody who could duplicate the voice, either by ventriloquism or any other form of trickery, but nobody managed to claim the reward. Most of what Bill had to say was fairly innocuous, but then the investigators asked how he died. This was his reply.
"I've been blind. Then I had an hemorrhage and I fell asleep and I died in a chair in a corner downstairs.
I went blind and had a hemorrhage and then I fell asleep and I died in a chair in the corner downstairs." Not all of the activity was so convincing. At one point later on in the case, Janet was caught on video bending spoons and trying to bend an iron bar. She was also seen banging a broom on the ceiling and hiding Gross's tape recorder. The investigators claimed that they could see straight through these amateurish tricks and that they were nothing like the rest of the phenomena. In an interview years later, Janet and Margaret admitted that they did fake some things. Maybe 2%, they said. In the end, it was a Dutch medium that brought the case to a close in late 1978. Invited to the house by Guyly and Playfair, the medium went up to one of the bedrooms on his own, spending around 15 minutes up there. then came downstairs and stated that the presence was gone. The family didn't hold out much hope. They had been visited by mediums before without any lasting effect. But after that, according to Guy, things just stopped. The Enfield case, whether or not there was any truth to it, is largely a classic example of poltergeist activity, even adhering to common phenomena such as puddles of water mysteriously appearing and thrown items feeling hot to the touch. If the children faked all of it, they certainly did their research. Despite their reputation as noisy spirits, the voice coming out of Janet's mouth is slightly more unusual when compared to traditional poltergeist lore. Poltergeists are known mainly for their knocking sounds. In fact, the French term is esprit frappeur, or knocking spirit. However, there are a number of historical cases which set a precedent for poltergeists speaking and even singing. As we considered earlier, poltergeist activity most often occurs around teenage girls, especially during times of turmoil and high emotion, which, having been a teenage girl, I can confirm is basically all the time. It certainly was a time of upheaval for Janet. Her parents were recently divorced and she was about to start secondary school. It's been reported that the activity was at its very worst on the 15th of December, the day that Janet got her first period. Janet left home aged 16 and is now married with children of her own. Peggy lived at 284 Green Street until she passed away in 2003. After that, another family moved into the house, having no idea of its past. They reportedly felt a strange presence in the house, and the kids would wake up in the middle of the night, startled by voices coming from the empty rooms downstairs. One night, the son woke his mum to tell her that he'd just seen a strange man in his bedroom. They ended up moving out after just 2 months. What happened in that house in the 70s has captivated and unnerved us for decades. The 1992 BBC mockumentary Ghostwatch was heavily inspired by the Enfield poltergeist, to the extent that Guy Lyon Playfair actually came on board as a consultant. If you haven't seen Ghostwatch, you absolutely must, it's wonderful, but do be prepared for a few sleepless nights. The case has also been featured in a number of TV shows and documentaries, and was the subject of a Sky Living TV series broadcast in 2015. Recently, the film The Conjuring 2 was based, very loosely, on the case, amplifying the, in reality very minimal, involvement of demonologists Ed and Lorraine Warren, and throwing in a load of overblown nonsense which takes away from the eeriness of the real-life events. Just one last note before I leave you. Years after the activity had come to a stop, a man came forward. He had heard about the case and had some information to share. His name was Terry Wilkins. He told the investigators that his father Bill had once lived at 284 Green Street and that he had passed away in the house. He had died of a hemorrhage in his favourite chair in the corner downstairs. Thank you for listening to Oddity. You can follow at Oddity Podcast on Twitter. Join me, Rowan Molyneux, next week for another journey into the strange and unexplained.